from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, this question. Why do some communities get dumped on with landfills and waste dumps and the industries that pollute? Because here's the thing, one of the best predictors of a person's health is their zip code. Our guest is the sociologist Robert Bullard. He's known as the father of environmental justice. He's in Utah next week to talk about how pollution is also a matter of human rights. We'll be right back.
Hey there, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. If you enjoy the show, we'd appreciate it if you did us a little favor. Find us on the iTunes store and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. It's valuable feedback for us, and frankly, the more reviews we have, the more listeners we can attract. Thanks in advance. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West, I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utahns in the Salt Lake Valley are constantly thinking about air quality, especially this time of year. Those of us who live on the east side figure it's bad everywhere. And it is, but there's a difficult truth here, that it's actually worse on the west side. And you can document it. In fact, researchers at the University of Utah are doing that very thing, documenting how air and noise and light are worse on the west side. And the question is why? It's a question Robert Bullard has been exploring pretty much all his life. Why it is some communities get dumped on with landfills and waste dumps and the industries that pollute, and others just don't. Bullard says this is a matter of environmental justice. In fact, he's called the father of the environmental justice movement. And Bullard is coming to Utah next week to talk about all of this. He's joining us today. Dr. Bullard is a sociologist, distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University, where he also served as dean of the School of Public Affairs. He joined us from Houston Pacifica Radio in Texas. Dr. Bullard grew up in the segregated South, and so he saw firsthand how, he's put it, place and race combine to create opportunities for whites and barriers for black people.
I grew up in the late 50s and 60s in a small town in South Alabama, and everything was segregated. I went to a segregated elementary school, middle school, high school, and my community was all black. And I can recall, you know, going downtown, and as with street lights and sidewalks and paved streets and all the amenities, the parks, libraries. However, when I came back to my community, we had none of that. The library was at my school, and when the school closed, the library closed. I had never, even to this day, I've never been in the library at in my hometown. However, that was commonplace. I never thought anything about it other than that's the way it was.
When did you start to think about it in terms of justice and civil rights?
I grew up in the 60s, and 60s was a time when, at the height of the modern civil rights movement, and at my university, at Alabama A&M University in Huntsville, all black university, and we were demonstrating, protesting in the 60s. And I went to college at Iowa State University, and I graduated in 1976 with a PhD and moved to Houston. And my wife was an attorney, and she was approached by this black community in Houston to file a lawsuit against this landfill that was being placed in this middle-class black suburban neighborhood. And she asked me to assist and collect data for this lawsuit. You know, when we went to the community, I recognized the fact that, you know, this was an all-black community. It was being treated differently. As I did my study, you know, looking at where all of the landfills and incinerators and garbage dumps and other waste sites were located, as we plotted it on a map. This is way back in 1979. You know, we're talking about 40 years ago. It became very clear that this was not accidental, coincidental. And so I reached back into my own childhood and say, well, this seems like something that I grew up in. And from then, you know, I started to make that connection and to see that all communities are not created equal. Even middle-income black communities, suburban community, like the one in Houston, was not somehow insulated from being dumped on.
You've written about how you were looking at the data and you came to realize that this wasn't that black people were moving into areas that had landfills and dumps. You were saying it's that these neighborhoods, they were already established long before these facilities came to be located there. What did that tell you? That this is not random, that there's this conscious choice, and race seems to be playing a factor, you're seeing.
Yeah, I started to expand the Houston study to say, well, is Houston so different that this is happening in Houston? And what we found is that this was not, you know, random. This was not isolated. It was a pattern that existed all across the South. That's how I wrote Dumping in Dixie. And Dumping in Dixie basically laid the groundwork for saying, well, this is not something that just happened. There was policies and practices. And for a large part, poor communities and African-American communities and communities of color basically were considered places that's acceptable for garbage. And what the communities, you know, the South and the United States, people are saying, no, we deserve the same quality of life as other communities. Our communities should not become dumping grounds and sacrifice zones for waste. And that's how the environmental justice became a major part of civil rights and human rights.
I wanted to ask you about how it was that this worked in Houston. Take Houston as an example, how city leaders were using these, you know, not in my backyard policies to basically, as you've put it, situate garbage dumps and incinerators in the city's black communities. How did they go about it?
Okay, this is the way it happened. You know, the fact that Houston, up until 1972, did not have a single African-American on its city council. These were decisions, land use decisions and growth decisions and siting facilities were all made by white men. And in a city that doesn't have zoning, so it meant that somebody had to say, put it there, put it here, put it over there. And because of from the 30s, up until 1978, 100% of all of the city-owned landfills, that's 5 out of 5, were located in predominantly black communities in Houston. And when I say predominantly black, that's like me saying my family is predominantly black. These are all black neighborhoods, and Jim Crow created the segregation.
Yeah.
6 out of 8 of the city-owned incinerators were in black neighborhoods, and 3 out of 4 of the privately-owned landfills were in predominantly black neighborhoods. So when you look at that strange, you know, scenario of one community getting more than its fair share of the nasty stuff, but less than its share of the good things like parks and playgrounds and good schools and grocery stores, that's a form of discrimination. And that pattern that we discovered in Houston actually plays out across the country. Something needed to be done in terms of policy and decision making.
You just kept looking. You looked in Dallas, you looked in Alabama and other places, and you described these apartheid-like systems, county and state and local officials, where no one was black and or part of a lower socioeconomic class, and they were making decisions. So you were seeing it throughout the country, I suppose.
Yeah, and I got a grant to look at the southern United States, and I expanded it to Dallas. All of the lead smelters in Dallas. During that period of time, I was doing the research. We're in black and brown neighborhoods. I went all the way to Louisiana and looked at the facilities along the Mississippi River, up and down what they call Cancer Alley, the petrochemical corridor. And it was black communities, in many cases formed right after slavery, that was closest to the plants. I went all the way to West Virginia, and a black community that had been in West Virginia since the 1860s, when West Virginia broke away from Virginia during slavery, and West Virginia was a free state. And this company sat down right on top of this community that was formed in the 1860s. And it's not just African-American communities that are impacted. It's poor communities, working-class communities, and communities that are physically located on the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah. You've written that every time you get a request to help a black community or a community of color fight a waste facility or a landfill, you say, whenever you're asked about that, that there's this voice in your head that reminds you about Dr. Martin Luther King's struggle for justice and for the striking sanitation workers. This was in Memphis in 1968. I thought this was interesting. Would you talk a little bit about that voice in your head and how you're thinking about that?
I was a senior in college when Dr. King went to Memphis, and the idea that he went to Memphis over striking garbage workers, you know, about environmental and economic justice, even though there was not a movement, a national movement around environmental justice then. And just 10 years after Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis over garbage, you know, the issue of Houston and garbage came to me. It came in 1978. So it always is in my head in terms of environmental justice and economic justice being basically linked to civil rights and Dr. King and the legacy that Dr. King left in terms of every community, every human being should have a clean and safe and healthy environment, and that that these are basic civil rights and human rights. But in many communities, they don't have the luxury of having a clean and healthy, sustainable environment. They have to fight landfills, incinerators, garbage dumps, and all kinds of negative externalities. And urban planners call them LULUs, locally unwanted land uses. And these locally unwanted land uses have an impact on the environment, but they also have an impact on health and quality of life.
Yeah. Well, I want to get back to that here in a moment. But tell me, what is a sacrifice zone?
Well, a sacrifice zone is nothing more than a geographic spatial area that has been targeted for unlimited amounts of pollution. You know, it's like it's easier to get three landfills if you have two. It's easier to get a second refinery if you have one. And when you basically say that you're going to designate one geographic area for these kinds of operations, it becomes a sacrifice zone. The community residents that live in those neighborhoods, they are basically considered collateral damage. That whole community is sacrificed. They receive unequal protection, unequal enforcement, and they basically get little help from government, and they get few of the jobs. People drive in, drive out, who get the jobs. And what they do get is they get sick. In some cases, they get their property values lowered and their whole quality of life lowered.
Tell us a little bit about Beverly Wright's work. She was one who had looked at these small fence-line communities and how they ended up with this really bad pollution. I think that's an interesting story, too.
Yeah, well, you know, I was working in Houston, and Dr. Beverly Wright was working in Louisiana. And as it turns out, she was in the belly of a lot of the environmental problems. Being in Louisiana and studying those communities up and down that 85-mile stretch from Baton Rouge to New Orleans along the Mississippi River, she could see that many of those communities emerged out of slavery. Former sugarcane plantations areas that was replaced by the petrochemical industry and the communities that were closest to those plants and the impact of the health impacts. And so the whole idea of environmental justice and environmental racism, it was very clear in that analysis in Louisiana that we call the Cancer Alley or the Ground Zero for environmental injustice. And during the 70s and 80s, you know, Louisiana was ground zero for more of the environmental struggles and fights and campaigns than any other state in the country.
You write that racism, as you put it, knows no geographic bounds. So in the South, it was black people because they're the region's largest racial minority group. In the Southwest, though, you say it's Latinos who get targeted. In some places in the West, you say it's Native Americans. It seems like the central theme here is what? It's racism, as you see it?
Yes, race. Race trumps class. And race is still the most potent variable for explaining where these health-threatening industrial facilities are located. For example, if we look at the 150 oil refineries in this country that's located in 32 states, 52% of the residents who live within a one-mile radius of these refineries are people of color. People of color only make up about 38% of the U.S. population. So we are overrepresented in the residential areas around these facilities. And that's African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans. Now, race is still an important factor, but income and class and poverty is also a major area. Yeah. If we go to West Virginia and look at mountaintop removal, it's not African Americans or people of color. It's low income and working class whites that's being impacted environmentally and health wise by mountaintop removal. And so, when we talk about environmental justice, it's not just talking about racism. It's also talking about issues related to income and class. And what we say is that no community deserves to be poisoned when we can have alternatives, when we can reduce the emissions and reduce the pollution and try to come and prevent instead of just allowing pollution to follow the path of least resistance, which historically has been communities that have very little power and very little resources.
Say a little bit more about that path of least resistance that industry follows when they're locating their factories or their facilities. You've talked about how traditionally upper-income white communities, they had an ability to resist. So the pollution, the bad light, the noise, that ends up in the poorer communities. So talk a little bit about that. So this is about influence. It's about connections. It also seems, Professor, to be about practical things like just the leisure time to be able to go to a city council meeting and protest the siting of a land, a landfill or something like that.
Yes, that is correct. So when we talk about how environmental injustice also map closely with access to resources, political access, access to experts, scientists, lawyers, and having the ability to have time and access to transportation to get to meetings and hearings and being able to hire your own experts to testify at hearings and at permit meetings, et cetera. And so a lot of it, again, comes down to companies will somehow avoid places where people are organized. This is not rocket science. You know, if you want to get a permit and get a facility located and you want to get it done quickly, you try to avoid places where people are organized and have their own resources to say no. And not just saying no, but have the wherewithal and the power to put that no into action. They're really tired because they're working hard and trying to put food on the table, pay rent, send the kids to school. And there's a community meeting and there's a newspaper throwaway where there's a notice in the public hearing. It goes unnoticed. And that's how things happen to some communities. And as I said before, the pattern is very clear. And that's how our environmental justice movement has really begun to mobilize and educate, inform people that they have to pay attention. They have to, you know, have the capacity, whether it's a church group or civil rights group or some type of, you know, children health group, PTA, to really take charge of what's happening in their community and be on guard. And they have to try to, you know, combat the unfairness by having the information and getting to those meetings and getting their voices heard.
There's something that's been going on here in Utah, Salt Lake County, over the past couple of years. And it's this conversation about what do we do with, in this particular case, shelters or facilities for homeless people. And then you hear people in neighborhoods reacting. They talk about that they don't want to lose property values. They're worried about security. Do you place those kind of concerns or things in this same kind of category of an environmental justice?
Yes, housing is a basic human right, and access to affordable housing and access, you know, and trying to develop a strategy to deal with homelessness, whether it's shelters or whether it's building low-income housing, et cetera. These are all built environment factors that oftentimes receive resistance from all kinds of communities. And it's not just white middle-class communities that resist homeless shelters. You know, middle-income, suburban, black communities also resist these kinds of things. We have to try to create a situation where we don't have all of the homeless shelters just packed into one area. And in terms of low-income housing developments are not just packed into one area and becomes very controversial in terms of where you locate these kinds of facilities that some communities, residents, feel are also locally unwanted land uses or LULUs. And in some cases, they place, you know, homeless shelters and low-income housing in the same bucket as they would a landfill incinerator or a freeway or a pipeline.
What are you learning about the changes, the institutional changes that are needed to level the playing field? What are the things that you're seeing that might be working, and what are the changes that you see that need to be done?
Well, I think it's important that when we talk about urban planning or land use and industrial facility siting, I think it's important that meetings are held in a way and at times that community residents, all residents can attend them. You know, having a meeting during the day, you know, at 3 o'clock when most working folks are at work and can't take off, that's not a good form of democracy. When we talk about enforcing environmental regulations and laws that are on the books, we talk about equal enforcement of environmental laws. When communities like here in Houston, that was hit with Hurricane Harvey. I mean, Houston was unequal when it comes to pollution before Harvey, and the storm, the flood, exacerbated those inequalities. And so when money comes down to fix the problem, we say that money should not follow money. Money should not follow power. Money should follow need. Environmental laws should be enforced in a way that provides equal protection for all and equal enforcement. We have to ensure that the most vulnerable population in our society, children, are not impacted in a disproportionate way by having schools that are located next to refineries or next to coal plants. That's not common sense. And a lot of the recommendations and the ways that we see as leveling the playing field and that's protective of a public health is basically common sense. And we say, take a common sense approach.
You've talked about how laws that codified racial segregation aren't on the books anymore, but this kind of thing is still happening. And you've also mentioned how over the last few decades, these environmental justice efforts have taken, this is how you put it once, two steps forward, one step back. How are you feeling about it these days under the current administration, the current political landscape?
Well, you know, currently there's a major push to dismantle a lot of the environmental justice initiatives in terms of the federal EPA and some of the other federal agencies, trying to weaken Clean Air Act, weaken, you know, clean water and safe drinking water and Superfund and all kinds of regulations that are on the books. And what, in many cases, those communities that have been saturated with pollution and those communities that are fence-lined with many of these polluting facilities, they see this as a direct attack and almost like a license to pollute and a license to make people sick. Because, for example, when we talk about weakening air quality standards, that has a direct impact on poor people and people of color who are disproportionately impacted by asthma. You know, African Americans, Latinos are 3 to 5 times more likely to be hospitalized or die from asthma than middle income white people. And so when we talk about, you know, environmental standards being enforced stringently, we're talking about health. And when they are weakened or when they are loosely applied, we see those numbers ticking up in terms of health impacts. And so it becomes not just a sexy environmental topic, it becomes life and death.
That's Robert Bullard. He's a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. He also served as dean of the School of Public Affairs. He's coming to Utah next week. On Thursday, he's going to be speaking at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. His lecture is called Race, Place, and the Politics of Pollution. You can find a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been asking, why is it some communities get dumped on with crappy air and landfills and waste dumps, and other communities don't? We were talking earlier with Dr. Robert Bullard. He's known as the father of environmental justice. We're going to turn our attention now to Utah. Joining us on the program is Luz Escamilla. She's the Democrat representing State Senate District 1, which includes the northwest side of Salt Lake and parts of West Valley. She's introduced a number of bills over the years on air quality, and this year she's focusing on the environmental impact of the proposed inland port on her district. She's joining us here in the studio. And Senator, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's always a pleasure.
When you listen to Dr. Bullard talking about communities of color and these conscious efforts to locate polluting industries and landfills and those kinds of things, how do you think about that in your own sort of personal situation, the way you've been looking at this?
Well, what I've learned is there's disproportionately impacting working poor communities, and because they disproportionately happen to be more communities of color that happen to be poor, I think that's where that correlation happens. Think about my district, which is the poorest district in the state. The way we measure that is the number of earned income tax returns. And, you know, so Senate District 1 happens to be there. That's the Northwest Quadrant, so everything west of I-15 in Salt Lake City and half of West Valley City. And you think about those demographics, it is the most diverse district as well. We do most of the refugee resettlement happens in that area. So, yeah, you took industrial growth, west side of the valley, most polluted area. The west side of that northwest quadrant is the most polluted area, not only in the state, but potentially in the entire region. And those inversions just happen to sit in there. And that's where a lot of, I mean, you have the airport, which is, you know, we're having great expansion in the airport. I mean, the amount of pollution every time a plane has to, you know, all whatever happens within the airport is.
Not to mention the noise.
Oh, yeah, the noise pollution. So we'll talk about that because most people think just air quality.
Yeah.
When you think about an environmental impact and the quality of life of someone, it includes lighting, it includes water, it includes sound, and of course, air quality. There's a lot of research focusing on how it disproportionately impacts communities of color, low-income communities, those social determinants of health. So children, if you think about children, most people care about children. They may not care about adults, but they do care about kids. They're starting their education life with achievement gaps already because of those social determinants of health. And it's so expensive. So if you're a little bit more selfish and you say, well, I don't live in that area, that really doesn't matter to me, we're all being impacted by this. At the end of the day, we're either paying it in a juvenile justice system, paying it in our healthcare system, because it is impacting, it's systemic. And even if they do their best, they can't get away from it. I live in Rose Park. My kids have asthma. I have asthma. I mean, I cannot not live there. That's my property. That's my home.
Yeah.
That's my community.
Yeah.
So if you're outside and you're like, well, you know, maybe they should not live there or they should move. I mean, some of those answers I get from people is like, no, this is someone's life. I mean, this is the air we breathe. I can't necessarily choose what I breathe or not. And studies show that it is happening and it's really impacting someone's life. I mean, your entire life will change because of this.
You say your thinking on this began about 5 years ago, at least, the questions of that medical waste incinerator or Stericycle in North Salt Lake. Is that the thing that got you started thinking about it in a real way?
Yes. I mean, from a legislative perspective, so I've been in the legislature for 10 years, and I have to say the legislature has done more of an air quality really in the last give or take 7 years than ever before. Yeah. I mean, it became... For obvious reasons. I mean, I think you can see it and chew it and taste it. It's so unfortunate, but it's real. Yeah. We also start seeing a lot of businesses that will, you know, we talk about economic development and hear, hey, welcoming the world to Utah. And businesses will show up. And I had an opportunity to be on some of those situations where they will literally get off the plane and be like, is this what you guys breathe? I'm not interested in bringing my business here. We'll just catch the next flight. Suddenly, conversations about, hey, yeah, education, economic development, we're now having to tie back to our air and how polluted things were.
Yeah.
But about 5 years ago, the Stericycle issue came very close to my district. So it's not in, Stericycle is not in my district, but because they're neighboring.
You're right on the edge.
I'm on the edge. I had constituents that were being impacted. A lot of mothers, young moms, approach me and start talking about miscarriages and how there was this disproportionate number of women that were losing babies because of something related to the environment, and they were trying to, you know, do more research in this, and it really caught my attention. I'm like, wow, this is something that's impacting them directly. I mean, they're like, look, many of them were new developments, so there were new homes. I have to say, a lot of it is questioning even planning, right? I mean, who thought? Because that company was there prior to the development of all those homes. I mean, the reality is Stericycle, at one point, located themselves far from the community. I mean, at one point, that was almost like rural Utah.
Yeah.
I get it. We're growing. And so the planning is critical. So a lot of that is also municipalities and their responsibility to do city planning in a responsible way. So now you have all these new homes, new developments, and families now saying, wait a minute. This is like a block away from a school. Like, what happened? So they took on it was a big legislative effort. And I started getting engaged. And I started looking into not only our laws, because we do have some laws in our books, enforcement. I mean, that was kind of like now I started learning that you can't enforce if you don't have investigators, if you're not funding adequately investigators. Our statute had this very odd, you know, a statute of limitation when it came to violators on pollution. 1 year, which is unheard of a statute of limitation of 1 year. So I started working to those policies. For me, it was more systemic, like, hey, this has to be a fair process. If you're a good neighbor, if you're a part of a community, why is it that everything else on statutes of limitations are 3 to 5 years and suddenly this one is just one? And then if that's the case, do we have enough investigators to do the rounds and actually make sure we're collecting adequate information? No, we don't. It will take more than a year to at least do a rounds for one investigator.
I want to ask you about that because you mentioned the statute of limitations, which to you it didn't make any sense. And you ran a bill to try to fix it.
Correct.
How'd that go?
Oh, wow. I'll say this. I've been there 10 years, a lot of bills, and I've made people angry. And then there's this bill.
Huh.
I mean, I felt
it stood out. It was different.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the lobbyists were very clear on industry, was very upset. And I couldn't get it. I'm like, especially large corporations. And I was trying to get, I'm like, why are you upset? If you're a good player, if you're a good neighbor, you should be the one supporting something like this. Because this is maybe the bad apples that are giving a bad reputation to industry. Right. And no, it did not go well, but I didn't let it go. I mean, I worked, I think several, it had to be at least two sessions till we got to a happy middle. And we did increase the statute of limitation by 1 year. So, and then we did, the other part was providing more funding then for adequate, you know, funding of investigators and the enforcement piece. So that's how I started this idea of getting involved. I co-chair our Clean Air Caucus, which is the only caucus that we have where it's, well, some of the caucuses that we have, but this is a very active caucus of legislators, bipartisan. We get together and work together with, you know, Republicans and Democrats to try to get good air quality policy. I've just been working now the last 2 years on another policy board for DEQ on that's a legislative board related to air quality. So, I mean, it's been an interesting, this is not my area of expertise. And as you know, we're generalists. We really rely on experts to give us information. I've done this great, now I have this great synergy with amazing environmental scientists, atmospheric scientists here at the University of Utah. They are doing some impressive research. Now, here's the thing. When you read some of that stuff, it really changes your perspective. I mean, And I'm sharing with some of my colleagues. Some of this is scary. I mean, I'm like now a little bit more paranoid than I've ever been. But some of the work coming out of the University of Utah of correlation between air quality and autism, right? Those high rates of autism. Harvard did one. University of Utah was part of that information and sharing that information. The new one about miscarriages. I mean, all of this is coming out and it's about our air quality. And in that process, I had two children, two babies, and one of them has asthma. My two-year-old has been diagnosed with asthma. And, well, I have asthma too, but now seeing your children, now it's very personal now.
We had a conversation recently with Dr. Daniel Mendoza. He's one of the pulmonologists that you're referring to at the University of Utah, digging deeply into this, and he talked about how just how granular they're getting in terms of their research. I mean, every single one of the buildings in Salt Lake County, I think it was 330,000 buildings, they're able to look at and map out pollution and these other kinds of effects, and they're seeing the difference between, I'm sure they're looking into noise quality and light. That's another one of these things. Mm. You can actually look at it on a map and see the differences.
It's been so impressive. The research is so detailed. So it goes down to where you are, where you work, where your kids go to school. So one of the things I work with was appropriations to continue the study, which Dr. Mendoza is one of the lead researchers of that study. And they're putting monitors, air quality monitors, on tracks, on the UTA tracks line. And you can see, I mean, so it's populating data instantly because it's moving. So you can see a minute ago or 10 minutes ago where the air quality, depending where the tracks is. And it's been so telling, just the pockets of areas where it's so heavily polluted. And it goes back to that correlation with, income, race, ethnicity. It's sad. So one of the other things I've been engaged in, and it's been just impressive, the school districts have been very open to work and try to find better alternatives to what happens when there's like a red day. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. In a red day in Salt Lake City, east side of Salt Lake City, school is not the same red air than red day that it is in Rose Park. And so we... part of I know what Dr. Mendoza and some of his colleagues are working on is trying to connect now correlation between absentees at schools and air quality. So when there's a bad day, how many kids miss school the next day? Because maybe they went out, they were in recess, they were running. Here you have problems. And, how many of them now are absent the next day? And it's actually, there is a very strong correlation. It's a statistically significant. I mean, from there, I think they will be able to do data-driven, evidence-based policy related to recess. I mean, when do you take kids out? When is not appropriate? And can you make those decisions based on information that's coming in now, that is being populated as we speak? And that information versus, the monitor from DEQ that happens to be 5 miles away from where our school is may not be adequate.
Is it difficult, Senator, to come out right and say, as Dr. Bullard has, it's racism. That's what's at play here. And are you willing to say, and when you do talk to fellow lawmakers or constituents or others about how you explain what's going on, are you explicit about that and say this is – it's not just about race. There's class here as well, but can you come out and say that? Are you comfortable coming out and saying
that? Yeah, I think there's, from a social justice perspective, absolutely. But for me, what's more important is being effective. So to me, this is about policy. When you are, if you believe in policy, and whether it's an incrementalism theory and methodology, it is what it is. I mean, am I going to motivate good law policy making by calling it racism? Probably not. Not in Utah. I think I do have serious conversations, and I'm pretty direct. I mean, what you see is what you get. I'm trying to explain from an economic development. There's so many other pieces to this conversation, and I'm hoping that one of those may be the one that catches the attention of one of my colleagues. Some of them may be, the drive may be the end of from a social justice perspective and saying, hey, this is not okay. Those disparities should not happen. Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's enough evidence talking about social determinants of health and, the impact to communities of color. So, yeah, it is what it is. It is within the institutionalization of racism. And, there are books, there's evidence. I don't know that motivates everyone, and that will be the drive.
So it matters. But it is what it is. Let's deal with it.
Oh, yeah. It's about change, right? So it's the outcomes. And for example, I'm running legislation this year, and this is my number one priority bill. It has to do with the inland port. Yeah. So the inland port, that's another show, right? We can talk about the inland port.
You're right.
It's in my district. So we have the construction of now the state prison in my district, the expansion of the airport, which will be not only this one, there's another one coming, right? I literally live 2 miles from the airport. I mean, I'm like one of those. My home is probably one on the edges there, and now we have the inland port. That's massive. I mean, set race aside.
Yeah.
It is massive. And how are we going to do this? How do we become responsible stewards of our land, right? So my colleagues love Utah, love the quality of life. It's all about how we live in Utah. That area, which is, by the way, the largest place right now in terms of growth, if we don't do this right, it's going to be really bad. So calculating this, I'm running legislation to create a baseline. So it's about measurement. It's about collecting data. You want data-driven evidence.
So before you do anything, you want to figure out what
correct the, what the we have right is. Now. And as we continue growth, we need to measure this. So this bill will create a baseline, but a very comprehensive baseline. This is not one monitor here and another monitor 10 miles away. No, this will create a comprehensive approach to data collection. And it will
we'll tell you what? What will that tell you, you think?
So we will measure, basically it's a longitude data collection on PM2.5 ozone for the air quality. We do lighting, water, and sound. So it will be a comprehensive baseline. Now, we're a little bit behind. And you will say, well, what do you mean? The Inland Port has not started, which is true. But the state prison already did. And I started talking about fugitive dust on the state prison 3 years ago, and I was running legislation to collect more data and make it public. Like, also, this will have a very big component of transparency. I want the people to be able to log into a website and know what is happening and what this information is telling us.
You mean what's going on? What kind of dust? What kind
correct.
Of pollutants? What kind of PM10
those level of PM2.5,
so
yes.
So you've got to get that information out to people so they understand exactly
correct.
The effects.
That's well, and let me tell you, some people don't care. I mean, I always try to put this in perspective. If you are making minimum wage, which is not a living wage, you have two jobs, three kids or four kids, barely make it to pay rent, probably this is the last thing in your to-do list. And that's where you talk about that institutionalization of racism, right? Because it does impact families. But there are other people that actually have some more time, some disposable income that allows them to actually have a computer at home and internet and everything.
But isn't that a big part of the problem is that in more affluent neighborhoods, they have the luxury, is the word that he
used. Engaged.
Of getting engaged.
Absolutely.
But in some of these communities,
civic engagement,
they can't be engaged
you're
in a
absolutely.
Way because they're worried about... They're working two jobs. They're as Dr. Bullard said, they're trying to put food on the table.
Yeah, it's, barely make it, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're right. And that's why I'm super excited when I see my colleagues that represent some of those communities. These are powerful women, and I say that, women of color. Mm. So your representation matters. And you know, and I think there's a lot of efforts when we talk about civic engagement and how we get people to, at a minimum, engage on who's representing them. And that makes a big difference. When you look at the fights at the legislature, you need individuals that are outspoken, that will say it how it is, that talk about social justice, that bring that perspective of inequality and disparities and gaps in every conversation.
But if you have powerful lobbyists with powerful industries talking to your fellow lawmakers up there, if you have a sense of kind of defensiveness, ambivalence among some lawmakers, don't want to exactly hear it. What are the chances?
You build relationships. Hmm. And a lot of the success...
But is that what you encounter? Is
those, oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it has changed.
Sure.
You know, I'm convinced that in my 10 years, I've been able to bring institutional change. And it has happened, maybe not when I wanted, like right away. It has taken some time, but we work with our colleagues. I mean, most of the time we agree, 95% of the time we agree on most things. Then you do have those more controversial issues where there's more dissonance or disagreements. But I think we can get places. It's not perfect. But this is an issue that we've been building information. We bring scientists, we bring people. This is evidence-based. This is very data-driven. If we have this conversation from an economic development perspective, when we talk about just the cost of healthcare, I mean, it's very expensive. And guess what? We're all paying for this. This is not an isolated, oh, well, they're paying it on their own. No, I mean, this is costing the state. If they're on Medicaid and CHIP, and when we talk about being absent in school, absenteeism, that actually gets people's attention.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, absenteeism? Wait, our kids aren't going to school? No wonder we're failing. You know, that isn't how you start a conversation. It's just a matter of, when I say building relationships, I get to know you. You get to know your colleagues and the interests and what drives them to make change. And I think that's how you succeed.
What do you make of, this is a question I put to Dr. Bullard, it's this conversation we've been having for years now, in at least in Salt Lake County, about where you put homeless shelters, for example, or facilities for the homeless. And you get these, you know, legitimate concerns from people who are like, and it's not just a sort of, you can dismiss it as not in my own backyard, but people talk about property values, they talk about security. What do you do about those questions? How do you confront that issue?
Well, we just had one with the in-between.
Absolutely.
And that was my appropriation for them.
Yeah.
They were in my district, and they found this better facility that was already equipped. They moved to the east side of Salt Lake City. And I'll say this first. Moments like that is when I feel so proud of representing my district, because you don't get people as hyped and as angry and as full sometimes of hatred, because some of those words are hate. I mean, it's like that you do in other parts of the valley. Mm. So, I mean, A, there's a sense of relief, like, whew. And almost like a parent when your kid is like, oh, yeah, they behaved, yes. but then you get into that question. So one of the things is, the reality is, yeah, I don't think most people will say, yeah, I want my neighborhood to be perfect and not have any type of facilities. Evidence shows, so best evidence or evidence-based practices show that the more integrated, whether it's a homeless shelter or some of these facilities with people with some disabilities or so forth, should be integrated to community. And most of the now practices are moving towards integration to community. So you want someone to succeed and be, you know, reintegrate back to a community, and it's through, you know, having these things integrated. And what do you do? You know, I asked this one of the individuals that was very frustrated, and she was just saying they should not be in any neighborhood. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, then help me. Where do I put the facility?
Yeah. What did she say?
Industrial area. That's a new word, I guess. So I'm like, those are not zoned for people to live. I mean, you can put a home in the middle of the industrial. I mean, so, and we have people from Salt Lake, you know, from the city there.
Well, what did that teach you about the way people think about this?
Well, it's everything is perfect as long as it's not going to bother them or they know how to interact with them. And the reality is, I think this is where you have to find strength and move forward. I mean, this is good public policy. I don't care what side of the aisle you are on this one. This is an issue of integration, of respect of humanity. And the only way we close those cycles of poverty is by having people integrated. The more we segregate, I mean, there's years of evidence showing that that never works, whether it's for education, whether it's for economic and wealth development, it doesn't work. And it's all on our best interest as a community. So
wait. So what you seem to be saying is, these are the realities of living anywhere, and
correct.
We all have to take on. We all have to share the burdens of dealing with this.
And now I'll give you an example. So when this whole homeless conversation happened, the West Side legislators came together, and we said, not on the West Side, on any of those, you know, new shelters. And people are like, shocked. Like, not because we don't welcome them. By the way, we've been welcoming everything. I mean, we just welcomed the state prison. We have the only facility with 300 beds for the parole violator center on the west side of Salt Lake City. 300 beds of parolees live in our community. We welcome them with open arms because we're sharing responsibility. We're part of the solution. All of the halfway houses are between West Valley, west side of Salt Lake City, and Ogden. That's it. All in the entire state. We're already sharing enough. Bring the responsibility somewhere else. I mean, I think it's a matter of fairness. So, and I have to say, I thank my colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats, in leadership specifically, of that conversation, which included Representative Speaker Hughes and President Niederhauser during that time, of saying, we're going to take this out. We're going to move and start pushing somewhere else, outside also of the West Side, because they carry a whole of the load for, I mean, not only, and the West Side, that includes West Valley and also Ogden. If you look, this is, again, I'm not lying, this is just the numbers. Those institutions are located in those three areas. why. Homeless people come from all over the state. People with problems, whether it's parolees or, you know, they're everywhere. So, you know, they share the responsibility. I call it share the wealth. And I'm happy that those places are going to be all over the communities.
But how realistic is it to say that? It seems like these are so entrenched. I mean, we've already planned our communities. And there's this assumption that that's where that stuff goes, the West Side. So how honestly optimistic do you feel about changing something that seems so ingrained now?
Well, I think the irony is I think that is going to change. And that will create other issues with property values. I mean, right now, have you seen the property values in Rose Park? I mean, I can sell my home and make a lot of money now.
Yeah.
So that's changing. Inland Port is going to change a lot of that. I mean, I'm positive it's going to be tons of changes, a lot of new people that are going to be working in that side where, you know, that's where the growth is coming. Now, that will create other type of problems because it's going to push a lot of those communities that are already, you know, poor and low income, the working poor class, where they're not going to find housing. So housing, affordable housing, right? This is another crisis we're facing.
As neighborhoods
we
get
don't
gentrified,
have
correct, people gentrification. Get
displaced, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's going to change. It's going to take a while. I'm not going to lie. I think where we see and where you can measure that impact is in schools. I mean, schools have powerful information beyond the scores of kids and testing. There's many other societal issues and society issues that you can find in a school. I mean, so West Valley is the first minority-majority city. But if you go to our schools, we've known this for 15 years. I mean, Selig School District has been a minority-majority school for years. I mean, 30 to 40% of schools are already minority schools in our Selig Valley area. So things are changing. And sometimes the schools are the ones that are giving us kind of like direction. I remember having conversations 15 years ago of people, oh, well, they're changing demographics. Utah's still very homogeneous. I'm like, do you have a minute? I'll drive you to one of our public schools here on the West Side, and I'll show you how things are changing. Now, you're going to see them because they're under 18, right? So they're not voting right now. They'll be voting in 10 years. I mean, just wait. I think that's what's going to be changing. Mm. It's like you're not going to be able to hide it anymore because it's here. It's data. Like I said, it's just, you can't just disappear that information. It's too real.
That's Senator Luz Escamilla. She represents Salt Lake and West Valley's District 1 in the state Senate. I'll mention Robert Bullard's event, which is next week, next Thursday at noon. He's going to be speaking at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. His lecture called Race, Place, and the Politics of Pollution. You can find links to that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Roddy Nickpour, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.